You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, we'll ask whether Germany's newly hardline approach to extremism will yield the same confused results faced by its European neighbours. My guests, Raffaele Pantucci and Rosemary Hollis, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including why the US has sold over 100 tanks to Saudi Arabia. We'll be assessing the relationship between the two countries. And how do you solve a problem like Trump, especially when he says something like this?
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
All that, plus, is there a time and a place for audience participation? Well, on the show, hopefully. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Raffaele Pantucci, who's Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London. Welcome both to the programme. We begin in Germany. Today, authorities made raids on addresses in Duisburg, Dortmund, Dusseldorf and Hildesheim that are suspected, on people who are suspected of supporting Islamic State. Although no arrests were eventually made, it follows the attacks in Germany last month by Islamic extremists. And tomorrow, a raft of new security measures will be introduced, making it easier to deport extremists. Other proposals include the banning of the burqa and the relaxing of doctor-patient confidentiality rules if a patient is suspected of wanting to cause harm. Raffaele, we'll start with you. This is certainly your world. Now, we've seen many other countries try to amend laws and manoeuvre quite quickly to shore up their security. Do these kinds of changes look to you like sensible moves, moves that may actually have some impact?
I mean, it's very difficult to know, frankly, because the impact, of course, of these sorts of measures is always difficult to calculate immediately afterwards. I think certainly you can see that some of them are a direct response to what happened in the past month. When we look at the particular incidents of that we saw happen of the Afghan refugee who attacked some people on a train, and then the Syrian chap who blew himself up. In both of those cases, you had people who were migrants into the country, and in one of those cases they tried to deport him a couple of times, but it hadn't actually worked. So I think here, clearly trying to strengthen some of the legislation they have around that, you can see that's a response to it. I think some of the other measures we're seeing there, this question around the veil, that I suspect is a bit more of a kind of knee-jerk reaction that's more responding to the sort of public mood. I think those sorts of measures are always very risky to sort of push through after an incident like this, because they are usually a sort of response to emotion rather necessarily than a response in any sort of practical sense.
And Rosemary, it's clear that some of these issues and some of the things being raised are about the why, you know, kind of, I guess, answering questions that are coming from a broader part of the community saying, you know, we want something done. So, as Raffaele says, the question about the burqa is not really going to change terrorism, is it?
Yeah, I think it's important to ask ourselves, how much is this Angela Merkel and her government trying to row back from the position that they took just under a year ago, when she said all the doors were open to these poor stranded refugees and we can do it, we can integrate them. It's also important to realise that some of the backlash as a result of the attacks in the past month has nothing to do with new migrants and Angela Merkel's policy. And at least two of them are homegrown. And one of them by an alleged admirer of Hitler and the Aryan race, as opposed to in the name of Islamist extremism or ISIS or whatever. And they compounded the sense across Europe that when does the mental well-being, the mental health of the perpetrators of attacks become more important than whether or not they invoke Islam. So I think it's been important for the German government to show that they are taking steps that will improve German intelligence. And actually, I would say that the burqa issue does have to do with identity and whether you can tell someone's concealing a lot, including their gender, under a burqa. So I don't think it's only a knee-jerk reaction. I think it has an intelligence value to insist that people at least show part of their face and that the government show that it's doing things that are sensible. I suppose the one thing that irks me is that in the face of the rise of nationalism across Europe, the idea that there's a good German and a dodgy German, there's a proper Frenchman and there's the others, it could get very nasty in terms of ethnic and sectarian terms as to what is a trustworthy citizen.
That question, just coming back again, Rafael, the question of the burqa. Again, this talks about, I guess, many communities in Germany, big cities, have seen large numbers of people arrive and they see people, you know, still holding on to their, you know, their past heritage and where they've come from. One of the other strange questions that has come up, for example, connected to this almost, is whether people should be allowed to have two passports. And there's a question that people must be forced to give up any other passport. They must become proper Germans. Now, we see in most countries, you know, the nature of how people travel. In fact, we saw in Germany only a few weeks ago, people saying, who are in government saying, let's offer, you know, passports to all the Brits working here in Germany. Let's offer them, you know, two passports because we want them to stay here. They should feel secure. Again, some of these things, they don't really seem to have a huge logic, but they seem to be saying, we need to make you more German. We need to bring you into the fold. It's a complicated balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it certainly is a very complicated. I mean, Germany's had a long history of questions around this. You know, before everyone got very concerned about ISIS, there was a lot of concern about Islamist terrorism more generally. You're looking towards sort of Al-Qaeda and radicalization that's happening amongst them. And in Germany in particular, the difficulty they always had was some of, you know, people who were born to some of the first generation of Turkish migrants who'd moved to Germany in the sort of post-war period. Their children weren't necessarily entitled to German passports. And so you had these odd situations where individuals were being left, were sort of potentially being booted out of the country, having been brought up in Germany, having radicalized and decided to sort of go fight abroad to come back home and then present a security threat. And they were actually perfectly, the government was able to sort of boot them out of the country and send them back to what was their sort of native land, which was Turkey, which was the passport they inherited from their parents, because they'd never actually got a German passport. So I think there have been some questions around this, that sort of the security side of nationality and identity for some time in Germany. But I think it is a very difficult one, because I mean, when you're talking about sort of terrorism radicalization, you know, a lot of the reasons why people sort of associate themselves with a group is because they feel that it represents their identity better than the one they've sort of been born into. So it is something that does feed into their into the problem and into the issue. And then, you know, within a country, you can see that groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda or far-right groups will feed on the sense of nationalism to sort of strengthen their own base and to strengthen their identity. And they're very much pointing, they always point to themselves as an alternative to another sort of identity that the one that they're fighting against.
Well, Esme, you touched on an interesting point about Angela Merkel, this open door policy that we saw just over a year ago. For German security services, it must be an almost impossible task. If a million people arrive in the country within a matter of months, you know, you take basic documentation from them, but you don't know who a million people are. And normally how policing works is through a community level, through knowing who lives where, people knowing their neighbours. A million people arriving like that, it has probably delivered to the Germans a security threat, which is almost impossible to deal with, isn't it?
Well, she keeps saying, yes, we can. I think that a lot of the migrants who've arrived in Germany and felt very much welcomed in the early days a year ago are now experiencing the bureaucracy that's involved in checking their papers and finding out exactly who they are and putting them through German classes and finding places to distribute them around Germany. And of course, the other members of the European Union have said no to the Germans' request that these migrants be shared out across the continent. And the Turkish end of the bargain that was supposed to stop the flow once the Germans had decided they could take no more has fallen apart because of the coup attempt on Erdogan and his reactions to it, which involves firing a lot of senior people, including in security services and, more to the point, armed forces on the border with Syria. So I would say that there isn't a firm, satisfactory and comprehensive policy in place, and you can find glitches in all aspects of all the measures that are being proposed. And we're just going to have to, as Europeans, whether the Brits are part of the story or not, we're just going to have to muddle through and improve on a number of counts. But it's the kind of problem that needs tackling at every single level.
Rafael, when you look at what these countries are doing, France, Belgium, Germany, do you see any hopeful signs of anybody beginning to understand how they begin to police this situation a little bit better? And as Rosemary said,
you've got to get rid of the idea that there's some secure place that you can police so that everybody feels all right in Europe again. I think that era's gone.
You're saying we just have to live with a higher level of fear and a higher level of awareness?
No, we've got to get the fears into proportion, because the chances of getting stabbed by a terrorist are pretty small still. Mm. And we also have to look at our identity issues. What does it mean to be German? And what does it mean to be alienated from society? And is it possible to have tolerance of a variety of different religions without agitators, without nationalists, without populists, without populist press playing on people's prejudices and fears and creating problems where they need not be?
I agree with you, but Rosie, on the question of this alienation, which is often kind of brought up in this debate, is, I guess what's intriguing is when you look at the countries which have been the most alienating to this whole process, if you go to, you know, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, you know, who are saying, don't stay here, we don't like you, you can linger here for a few months, none of them have had any attacks. All the attacks have happened in the countries where they've said, let's go out of our way to try and integrate you. Let's try and see what we can do. It's oddly the countries which have said, yeah, we've got no truck with you at all, that have come out of this, oddly, a little bit better.
Well, because I think there's two questions. So on the one hand, if you're looking at external groups, who are they targeting? They're not targeting the countries in Eastern Europe. They're targeting the ones in Western Europe who they see as the enemies who they're fighting against. So on the one hand, there's that thing. The other thing to point out is that actually, if you look at a lot of the attacks that we've seen, with exceptions, and a couple of the ones in Germany recently were clear exceptions to that, you see that the individuals who are involved are actually people from those very countries who were born there, who are second-generation migrants. And so the sort of problem is one that's homegrown and actually comes from those communities and individuals who've gone to foreign countries, connected with groups, and then come back with this sort of lethal intent. So I think that that's kind of why you're seeing more of the targeting happening there. I think if you're looking at the countries in Central Eastern Europe, the other point to make is that they've got quite aggressive policies about booting people out, quite frankly. I don't think they have any qualms about sort of saying, well, you know, you're a potential problem to us, so we will just move you on or boot you out of the country to go somewhere else.
Well, I was going to ask a supplementary question there, but I think we should move on. The selling of weapons is never an easy industry to put a positive spin on, but you'd do well not to sell $1.1 billion worth of tanks, perhaps, to a nation that has reportedly just killed 21 people in a war zone this week, most of them civilians. The US has agreed for the sale of 130 Abrams battle tanks, 20 armoured recovery vehicles and other equipment to Saudi Arabia, which is engaged in a bloody conflict with its neighbour Yemen. The sale once again highlights the US's confused agenda in the Middle East as it strives to supposedly bring peace to the region. Rosemary, should the US be a little bit more discerning about who it sells
weapons
to?
This is an embarrassing ongoing story for the Americans, and the British for that matter, the extent to which they are culpable in the pursuit of actually Saudi intervention in Yemen. It's not so much a Saudi-Yemeni war as the Saudis have taken it upon themselves to intervene in internal warfare inside Yemen, where you have at least four parties competing to control the country. You have the Houthi community, which can bisect be identified as closer to the Iranians or the Shia of Iran than to the Sunni of Saudi Arabia, and has now been firmly labelled as having the support of the Iranians, with whom the Saudis are at odds in Syria, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, in the Gulf, and therefore see this as another attack by Iran. So they've got reason to want to prevent the Houthis prevailing in Yemen. You also have a contest between Yemenis, the former president, and a new president who replaced him in the context of the Arab uprisings, the Arab Spring, so-called, and with whom the Saudis and other Gulf Arabs were actually quite satisfied. But he's now had to flee in the face of the Houthis into Saudi Arabia. This is President Hadi. So the support for him, you have Al-Qaeda, which was a big nuisance to Hadi and his predecessor in southern Yemen. And they now are somewhat overtaken by the possibility that ISIS will make this another of their playgrounds. And in the midst of all of this, you have secular and religious. You have ordinary Yemenis and a parlous economic situation and an absolutely chronic shortage of water. And then this is compounded by the Saudis simply not being very good at warfare and killing indiscriminately a large number of civilians and demolishing large parts of Yemeni cities. It's a tragedy.
But Rosemary, just quickly on the actual sale, do you feel then this sale should not have gone through?
I think it's actually a bit academic to pick on this one sale. The support of the Americans and indeed the British for the Saudis, the Saudi armed forces, the Saudi National Guard, over decades has to do with selling them kit. They happen to have, fortunately for the defence industries of the UK and the US, plenty of money with which to buy the latest equipment, which keeps the industries turning over. And along with those sales of actual weapons platforms goes the sale of training packages to work with their pilots, to work with their soldiers. And in that sense, it's an individual moment or item in a long list. And to stop that would have to raise questions about, well, you know, are we going to stop the whole relationship? Since that's inconceivable, one has to suggest, therefore, that they be more serious, this is the Americans, with the Saudis over their strategy and objectives in Yemen. They have complained, but they haven't stopped it.
Rafaela, can you spot a scrap of morality in this sale?
I mean, look, I think the US and Saudis have a very strong relationship. So, of course, it makes sense that they would do the arms sales. In some ways, I think the point that Rosemary made around how much this showed up, the quality and caliber of the Saudi forces, I think is the important point to remember here. And it plays into a sort of bigger issue that you see in terms of sort of Western support of various countries' armed forces, is this whole question of, you know, we often look to conflicts around the world and say, well, what we need is, if we can't send our people in, then we need to have a sort of local force that we can build up and they can do it. And, you know, what we often see is actually that doesn't really necessarily end up with a more effective fighting force on the ground. And arguably you can see what's happened with the Saudis is similar again in that regard.
And just on the what if it didn't happen question. So if you pull back and, you know, Saudi wasn't involved there, are you looking, Rosemary, a better scenario? If, you know, as you say, you know, Al-Qaeda
well,
can take it over.
That's a very good question. And if you stopped this one sale of tanks, which allegedly is to replace some that were lost by the Saudis fighting in Yemen, what would it achieve? And it might make a few people feel that they'd done the right thing in this circumstance. But throughout the history of the war in Yemen, there has been a reluctance by non-Gulf Arabs to get involved because they recognise that they're not in a position to prevail there, to sort it out. And perhaps it's worth mentioning as well that the Americans are also guilty of bombing parts of Yemen in pursuit of first Al-Qaeda operatives and latterly ISIS. And this is targeting by the Americans, in some cases, you know, basically accusing someone without trial, you are guilty and we are going to kill you. And you have absolutely no international law backing to take that kind of action. And there may be collateral damage. So, as you're asking me to comment, would it make a difference if this one sale didn't go ahead, only in the context of a much broader discussion about what's going on here, should it be going on, and what could constructively be done to help the Yemenis?
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Raffaello Pantucci and Rosemary Hollis. Coming up next, Donald Trump may have just called for the assassination of Hillary Clinton. Yes, really.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Istanbul, our bureau chief is Christopher Lord.
For us here at Monocle, Turkey has a vital position, not just in the Eastern Balkans, but also looking towards the Middle East, towards Central Asia, and towards these countries that are very, very quickly emerging economically. But Turkey also occupies an extremely important role over the next few years, that's in terms of a kind of economic model, and also in terms of city building, as a model of how you make sure that you're building a society that can continue to evolve and change as that population evolves and changes too.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Donald Trump has said something shocking. Again, or did he? In a moment, we'll discuss the difficulties faced by the media and commenting on a man who seemingly has no filter and no quality control. But first, let's hear from the man himself. This is what he said regarding the issue of gun control at a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina, yesterday.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day if Hillary gets to put her judges.
Well, the question is, did he call for the assassination of Hillary Clinton? It's extraordinary we're even discussing this, Raffaella. The notion, a man who could be president of the only real superpower in the world, could be potentially calling for the assassination of his rival during the electoral race. Even as a joke, it sounds unbelievable that we've got to this position. What's your take on Mr. Trump and what he has to say?
I mean, it's sort of gone way beyond a parody at this point, which is sort of what it felt like at the beginning. It was kind of a joke. This guy who's this sort of national clownish figure in the United States would actually genuinely be in with a shot at the presidency, and now he really is. And I mean, this sort of a comment, I think, is you know, shocking in the sense that it can even be interpreted in this way. I mean, I actually, listening to it, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of room for interpretation in his sort of comments. But, you know, certainly the fact that there's room for interpretation to it to be even hinted in this direction is pretty shocking in itself. And I think there was an interesting comment that I heard General Mike Hayden, the former head of the CIA and the NSA, who's a Republican, and you know, you would thought would support the Republican candidate, but it's been one of these sort of senior national securocrats who's come out very strongly against him. He said that, you know, if you're in that position, you can't, you know, it's even the implicit things in what you say that have to be borne in mind because of the sort of weight and gravitas of the role that you're holding. And so the fact that Trump isn't even able to maintain a sort of veneer of seriousness around these sorts of things and just shoots off his mouth pretty much at will on whatever he wants. And we've seen this repeatedly over the campaign. I mean, just does continue to seem to disqualify him from actually getting this role. The thing that I just don't know, and I think remains a huge open question, is how much actually is this damaging him. You know, I'm very aware of the fact that a lot of the media I read tends to be, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the press, which frankly have truck with him and will publish long articles about, you know, how corrupt he is, how crooked he is, how much he lies and whatever. But I don't think that a lot of his supporters are necessarily reading that same media. And I suspect there is a whole echo chamber out there. And I just don't know how big it is that actually is listening to him saying, oh, yeah, right on. You know, this is the man. And it's genuine sort of concern about how, whether we are understanding it correctly, looking at it through this lens that says that, you know, this is a trope. How could any presidential candidate genuinely say this when, you know, it's possible that there's a large community out there that say, you know what, He's right. The establishment is crooked and a mess. And frankly, we need someone from outside it to try to clean it up.
Another analysis of what Trump has been doing is that he's been playing on the desire for people to have a winner, people to have a leader, a strong male paternal figure. And insofar as the New York Times and other erudite media outlets try to catch him on the facts and try to fault him on the validity of what he says about Hillary Clinton or anything else for that matter, are barking up the wrong tree. They're trying the wrong tactic, because in order to refute the accuracy, to challenge him on the accuracy of his remarks, you'll end up repeating the remarks in order to disprove them. And all you do with a figure like Trump is reinforce in people's minds these strong statements that he's made. They're not listening for a reasoned explanation of what's actually going on and the extent to which national security was indeed compromised by Hillary Clinton using her own email, or the number of personnel that were or were not in Benghazi at the time that the ambassador was assassinated, and whether that makes her, in fact, the one that's guilty of a crime. And the whole idea of slogans like lock her up and, kill the problem, stamp it out, is his approach. And one can see his reference to the Second Amendment, folks, in that light, because you stand up to your problems and you eliminate them. And that's why, clearly, he likes President Putin of Russia. Mm-hmm. And there is a dissatisfied, angry section of the American population, which does seem to include disproportionately white males who are not doing too well economically, who like this kind of standing up for what you believe in and telling the pussy-footed, namby-pamby liberal types and the rich internationals to go take a hike.
Well, we're going to take a hike ourselves and a dash and a run and a swim, because we're going to the Olympics for the final minute of this show. Brazilian fans have been doing what most fans are encouraged to do, cheering, whooping and lots more at most Olympic events. But this hasn't been popular with some of the competitors. Sports such as table tennis and fencing are more used to being played in a quiet and intensely focused arena. So is there a time and a place for a whoop and a cheer? Rafael, I think you've got some good Latin heritage in your background. Are you a whooper?
My name's a bit of a giveaway on that one, isn't it? Yes.
Are you a whooper at events?
Well, I mean, it depends. I can't say I'm a huge watcher of sports events. So, you know, when I do go, I do get very into them, though. But whether I would whoop at a table tennis event, I can't really see myself doing.
Rosemary.
Well, I certainly would if it was my friends playing, I have to say. You know, you'd be screaming with laughter. But you'd be in extraordinary trouble. We've had this with tennis at Wimbledon. You know, what is the correct behavior? And if the crowds make too much noise, or your opponent makes too much noise, does it put you off your concentration? And how far do you take that line? And maybe if the nerves are so tense and everybody's so on edge, we'll then have a backlash and people will complain that I was overcome by stress because everybody was so uptight.
Rafa, just we've got a few seconds left, but oddly, don't you think it's quite a nice kind of soft power thing for the Brazilians? We like to think of Brazilians as joyous, involved, a little bit colourful, a little bit noisy, and you know, maybe they're playing up a little bit to national stereotype, but it's great to hear them so involved with the games that had so many question marks against it before they started.
I mean, look, I think it's a great story from that perspective. It shows people getting very excited. I remember watching, I think it was the BBC last night, who was doing a story about how empty the stands were in a lot of events. So in some ways, it's great to read this story. This is actually, some people are going to these events and getting very excited by them, because it does help that sort of, you know, cultural vision of the country.
Well, I'll whoop and I'll shout and I'll holler for both of my guests today, who are Rafaela Pantucci and Rosemary Hollis, long marathon sprinters, both of them. thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. But that's all we have time for today. The show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, a Brazilian who's probably whooping at this very moment, and Patrick Hahn. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next, then at 1900. 100 Hours, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily, which is at 2200 hours. Midori House, well, it's back at the same time tomorrow, of course, which is 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.